Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome everybody to the Lifeboat Hour, Sunday, November 9, 2014. We thank you for joining us, and we also apologize again for technical difficulties last Sunday night. Just remember that any time you have technical issues in listening to the show, just wait maybe an hour or so until the next show comes on, and you can visit the archives at prn.fm and click on shows and scroll down to the Lifeboat Hour, and you should be able to hear us just fine. We had a great show last Sunday night as I interviewed Alan Herrera, director of Aluna, a beautiful new documentary on the Kogi people of Colombia and their message to the non-Indigenous world. If you haven't listened, go to the archives and do so by all means. I do want to make just a brief mention here of my webinar, Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, which began last night. Our guest was Dr. Linda Bender, author of Animal Wisdom, and our guest next week is Guy McPherson. Even if you didn't attend live last night, if you register, you'll have access to that session and all sessions, whether you're present for the live session or not. And the best way to register is to go to synccast.net, that's spelled synccast.net, and sign up there. This is an incredible opportunity to be with our amazing guest speakers, to ask them questions, to connect with other kindred souls, and create a beautiful ending for 2014. The webinar continues every Thursday night through December 18, skipping Thanksgiving. So please join us for this unique and unprecedented opportunity. Again, the link for registration is www.syncast.net. syncast.net. As most of you know, I met Mike Rupert in 2000 and began writing for his website, which at the time was From the Wilderness. And I started writing there approximately in 2004. I was very involved with FTW for a couple of years, and during that time, I met another brilliant FTW writer whose articles were wonderfully crisp and fresh and well-documented, and that writer was and is Jamie Hecht. Now, I'm thrilled to have Jamie on the show tonight, and I want to tell you a little bit about him. At that time, back in 2004 or so, Jamie was living in New York City, and we met in person at the now famous Peak Oil Conference at Cooper Union, which happened in April of 2006. I lost track of Jamie for a while, and then he turned up somewhere online, and I learned that he was living in Los Angeles and working on his marriage and family therapist license. Having been a therapist myself back in the 80s and 90s, and now being a life coach, I became very curious about Jamie's career change because I knew that with what he knows about collapse and catastrophic climate change, I was pretty sure he would be one of those few therapists that people who are concerned about these issues could talk to. So recently, I reached out to Jamie and asked him to come on the show. Jamie Hecht received his PhD in English and American Literature from Brandeis University in 1994. He's the author of four books and is a literary scholar and a former professor of literature. He performs Shakespeare with the Los Angeles Shakespeare Troupe, the Porters of Hell's Gate, and is a fourth-year seminarian in training at the New Center for Psychoanalysis. He practices psychotherapy as an intern at the Relational Center in West Los Angeles, and he can be contacted at www.jamiehecht.com. He also has a poetry blog, poetrypoliticscollapse.blogspot.com. Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Jamie.
Thanks so much, Carolyn. I really appreciate the invitation.
Well, first of all, I'd like to have you tell us about your connection with Mike Rupert and From the Wilderness and your own waking up to peak oil and collapse.
Sure. I lived for most of my life in New York. I moved to Los Angeles in the middle of 2005. And in the late 90s, I had looked into the assassination of President Kennedy and the excellent work that John Judge, who just happened to perish in the same year, 2014, as our friend Mike Rupert, and who was also a kind of lion of the political justice movement, with a tremendous archive in his head. I'm speaking now of John Judge, who founded the Coalition on Political Assassinations. And I attended that conference and the JFK Lancer conference. And this sensitized me to the systemic injustice and indeed disinformation in which the intelligence community can be found engaging. So when one morning in Brooklyn, the first plane hit the first tower, I immediately thought, where on earth is the U.S. Air Force? And when the second plane hit, it became clear that this may well be a false flag operation because it's the most powerful air force in the world, and it was apparently unable to defend the financial capital of the United States, Lower Manhattan, and the military capital of the United States, the Pentagon, even though the Pentagon has $1 trillion with which to defend itself and work its will in the world. It seemed to me absurd that not a single fighter plane managed to interfere with these attacks, and I thought, all right, this just murdered 3,000 New Yorkers, and I feel like, as many people did, I take this rather personally and wanted to do something, even if it was a futile drop in the bucket. I wanted to use whatever gifts I had at my disposal, my ability to write, for instance, to try and contribute to the truth coming out. It doesn't bring anybody back, but you can do right by them. And that's how I had felt about the murder of President Kennedy and of Robert Kennedy as well. So I looked around asking myself, who's doing the best work about what truly happened here? It became evident to me from Google searches that led me to fromthewilderness.com that the person who was doing the best investigative work about the 9/11 attacks was this this strange fellow, Michael C. Rupert. And then I watched his DVD called Truth and Lies of 9/11, and it explained how 9/11 was achieved and the motives behind it and the mechanics of the cover-up. And all of this looked very much like the same kind of deep event which I had been acquainted with. The phrase deep events comes from the great, brilliant founder of deep politics. He contributed that phrase. His name is Peter Dale Scott. You may know him, and he has written a number of really wonderful books about the American deep state and the secret history of the United States. And the book in which he invents the term deep politics is called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. So it became clear to me that 9/11 was a false flag event or deep state event of the form of the Kennedy assassination. And since that book, Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, Peter Dale Scott has more recently written accessible essays and indeed books about the commonalities between the political assassinations of the 1960s and the 9/11 attacks. So I found Mike's work and learned that although he lived at that time in L.A., he was coming to New York City to give a speech about 9/11 and the secret government at the Riverside Church in Harlem. I was living in Harlem at that time, unless I have the chronology screwed up, because I moved from Brooklyn to Harlem at some point, often moving around inside the five boroughs. And I went to hear Mike speak, and he was electrifying, as usual. And afterward, I approached him and said, you don't know me from Adam, but I'm a great admirer of your work, and I have a deep need to contribute to getting the truth out. How can I be of service? I'd like to write for you. I gave him my card, and on the back of the card was written Counterpunch to remind him of who I was, because I had published two essays on Counterpunch, just two. I never had an official relationship with Counterpunch, but it was at that time edited by the late Alexander Coburn, and spelled Cockburn, but it's apparently Coburn, and Jeffrey St. Clair. And one of them was called Chairman of the Sandwich Board, which was about an experience I had going to an anti-war demonstration at the UN, where I went on the wrong day. And I thought, all right, if I'm prepared to march against war with other people for social support, perhaps I should be prepared to do it alone also. And I made a sandwich board with some oak tag from a shop on the corner, and walked around Manhattan with a sign that said, "Stop this racist war." And I wrote that piece about the reactions to it. And the other piece I had published in Counterpunch was about Gerald Ford and the CIA. Now, you won't find those articles on Counterpunch anymore, because one of the writers at From the Wilderness, and an excellent author and webmaster in his own right, is a fellow named Mark Rabinowitz, who lives in Eugene, Oregon, and he's also an independent journalist. And he's a harsh critic of the mainstream left, which does a lot of great work but does not discuss deep politics, in part because they are foundation-funded, and those foundations are connected to privileged groups who don't want Americans discussing deep political events like 9/11 and political assassinations. This fellow, Mark Rabinowitz, at one point emailed Counterpunch and asked them whether I had been paid for the stories. I hadn't, and I never expected to be paid. I don't think Counterpunch pays any of their writers, and that's reasonable enough for a nonprofit. But apparently the editors felt that Mark was being critical of them for asking this question, and without consulting me, they pulled both stories. And when I called them to ask about it, they were very hostile indeed, and that's my weird Counterpunch story. At any rate, I gave Mike this card, and he said, "I don't normally do this, but I have a feeling I should give you a shot. Here's your first assignment. Write an essay on the limited hangouts of 9/11. So I did. I wrote a piece called, it was my first FTW piece, and it was called "Failure and Crime Are Not the Same Thing, The Limited Hangouts of 9/11. And Mike was very pleased with it, and it ran on November 22nd, 2003, which is, of course, the anniversary of the act of state that murdered President Kennedy. Mike was sensitive to that, too. That's how I first met him and got involved. And later, just a few months later, in 2004, in the summer, Mike was wrapping up his writing of his terrific book, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil. And I'm the one who's to blame for that very lengthy subtitle. That was one of mine. But Mike wrote the book, and I edited it. And I flew out to L.A. and spent 2 weeks in his apartment with him. Hold up. He was writing. I was doing some minor rewrites and editing. And I was in his apartment in the room when he was on the phone with Barbara Honegger, the base historian of, I believe it's Andrews Air Force Base. Mm-hmm. And a number of other investigative research phone calls, and I felt I was watching history unfold, and I shall never forget that.
Well, you know, a couple of things come to mind, Jamie, as you're talking about that. One is, I want to let people know that the From the Wilderness website is still online. It's fromthewilderness.com, and it is an absolute Fort Knox of amazing articles on deep politics, on many, many things. And, of course, back in the day, 2002, 2003, is when the topic of peak oil was just coming to the fore, and Mike was deeply involved in that. And the other thing that came to mind is that John Judge, to whom Jamie referred, and Mike passed this year. But Peter Dale Scott, who you also spoke of, is going strong at, I think, approaching 90 or something like that. I see his articles from time to time online. Wonderful, wonderful writer, Peter Dale Scott. I highly recommend any of his articles or books. So then somehow and somewhere, Jamie, you decided to become a marriage and family therapist. What motivated you to go in that direction?
Well, several things, really. I began as a professor of literature and was quite dedicated to the humanities. I learned ancient Greek in a 10-week intensive course called the Latin Greek Institute in Manhattan in 1992 in order to become more deeply acquainted with the books and school of the ages, the canon of great texts in the humanities. And as I taught for about 14 years at various colleges and universities on the East Coast, chiefly in Vermont, New York, and New Jersey, it became clear to me that part of what I was doing as a literature professor was helping people to manage their existential anxiety, getting in touch with the meanings of the constraints around the human condition and the resources within the human condition with which we cope with those constraints and confront developmental tasks. Most of the people I was teaching were in some part of the age 20 transition, which lasts from about 18 to about 22. And they had urgent developmental tasks which they were confronting. And it meant a lot to me to be a respectful witness to people's struggles and even to occasionally say something useful. There's a deep harmony, it seems to me, between the humanities and psychology, certainly psychoanalysis, because Freud built psychoanalysis on the shoulders of literary giants like Sophocles and Shakespeare, whom I regard as the two greatest writers in the history of literature. And Freud famously said, "Everywhere I go, I find a poet has been there before me." So it wasn't that much of a switch. The humanities as a tenured vocation with a living wage is largely over with in the United States, because if you want to prevent a well-informed Democratic electorate with the ability to think for themselves, you can't have people studying the humanities. So you've got to cut those budgets and slash the departments and pay really sub-poverty wages to the non-tenured adjunct professors who are trying to make a living. And that's what's happened in the United States. There's a great book called How the University Works by Mark Bosquet, another book by another author whose name eludes me for the moment, but the book is called Unmaking the Public University, the 30-Year Assault on the Middle Class. And those are ways to get acquainted with how this works. But because that profession was largely over with, I looked around for another way to practice those same skills and enhance the relational part of what I had been doing. I briefly considered the clergy, but since my yearning for belief in God has never issued in a successful self-persuasion that the universe is, in fact, run by an invisible personal agency, that avenue was closed to me, and I became increasingly curious about psychotherapy as a profession. And the more I learned about it, the better appeared the fit between my training, my disposition, and this profession. So I undertook a master's degree in counseling and then began a practicum and a traineeship, which turned into an internship at a wonderful, politically progressive place in Los Angeles on Robertson Boulevard, a few blocks north of Venice Boulevard, 2717 South Robertson, called the Relational Center. And they do a kind of psychotherapy which comes with an implicit and sometimes explicit critique of consumer capitalism, because it's the order of things in which all our needs are supposed to get met not by other people and interpersonal attachment and exchange and relationship, but by buying products. So if any time anybody is depressed, he or she simply goes to the store and feeds the corporate monster of money and numbers by buying something, then you can have bigger profits and bigger GDP than you can if instead the person tries to get his or her needs met by going to the community garden or joining a meetup group that hikes around the city or having a an old-fashioned barn raising or a bake sale or any kind of a parents group, a mommy and me group, fathers and kids getting together. Any sort of relational communitarian activity is better than shopping for our neurology, because we are evolved to be social creatures. And if we don't get those relational needs met, we tend to experience poor health, higher levels of stress hormones like cortisol, poor sleep, anxiety, which sometimes we can't pin down as to its source. So I'm very happy there. I believe in the mission of the Relational Center, and I've been seeing clients there in groups and individually for psychotherapy for 3 years now. I have a listing in the Psychology Today directory of therapists, and people can find me there. But relationalcenter.org is the place to go. There's an intake form that you can fill out if you're interested in group or individual counseling. And in the section that says Why Seeking, that asks you what's bringing you in to seek therapy, if you're interested in seeing me in particular, you can write Jamie Hecht, Staff Counseling, and the intake form will go to me. That's the outer part of why I decided to become a therapist, a marriage and family therapist. I don't only do marriage or family therapy, but that's what the license is called, MFT. And the inner reason is that I am acquainted with the night, as Robert Frost says. I know what it is to experience feelings of helplessness, even feelings of worthlessness, difficult emotions like shame and guilt, regret, yearning, sadness. I have felt all these things and struggled with them, and I've struggled with various misfortunes. Other people had it much worse, other people had it much better, but I suffered the wounds and setbacks and made the mistakes that shaped my life. And by becoming a practicing psychotherapy intern and eventually psychotherapist, I discovered that the events that happened to me, divorce, professional setbacks, the awful political developments in the my native country, which I love, the United States. By becoming a psychotherapist, I was able to turn pain that had seemed like toxic waste, like dioxin and Agent Orange, lawn cuttings or nuclear waste, into mere poo, which, while unpleasant, is the best fertilizer. And from it can grow new skills and capacities, new abilities to self-soothe and to connect to other people, to rewrite the story of one's life, to build a skill set of how to cope with difficult feelings. And it's rather wonderful to see my pain benefit other people who are in pain, because I can join them in that dark place. I can say, as I often do, you don't have to cheer up, because, depressed person, you are seeing something which is true. The darkness is real, but it's not the whole story. And when you're on the dark side of the moon, to use this metaphor a bit further, it is exceedingly difficult to remember and even to believe that there is a bright side somewhere else, in time or in space. And it's one of the things people who are acquainted with one degree or another of emotional suffering can do for one another, is to say, yes, I validate the pain. I've been there. What you're seeing is right. It is a difficult, embittering world. But I am here to remind you of what you already know but cannot currently feel, and that is that it's also a world of love and learning and tenderness and vulnerability and cooperation with art, religion, relationships, politics as avenues of human self-assertion and cooperation. And that kind of reminder doesn't lift the pain immediately, but it is a seed that you can plant, and you can help the person to water the seed by having honest, respectful conversations about the things that are bothering them. And that has transformed my life. The only thing that has meant more to me in terms of personal growth has been parenting my own child. I have a daughter who's just entering teenage years now. And being a parent was this vast, endless richesse of opportunities to do and say the helpful thing instead of the traumatic one. It was a great wealth of chances to be open and loving and supportive and really let this kid know that her feelings are the most important thing in the world to me, because I believe that's what everyone needs to hear in their formative years. And if they don't hear that, then they need the relational support later. And psychotherapy is one way that people can get those needs met.
So thank you for all of that, first of all. And secondly, you know, I know from my own experience in this type of training that you've been going through, that one is profoundly changed, if one allows that, by the training. And so I'm just curious what you've learned about yourself. You've mentioned a little bit, but can you go more deeply into what you've learned about yourself in the training process to become an MFT?
That's a great question. Thank you. I learned about internal conflict. I had experienced plenty of internal conflict, as I think all of us do, but I never really turned to look at it and draw the implied conclusions that come with that experience until I started this training. And I came to learn at a deeper level than mere mental acknowledgement. Came to learn at a more emotional level that there are vertical splits in the ego. There are child parts of self with unmet needs that linger and cry out for help, which an adult experiences as anxiety or depression or irritability, because there's a one or another child part of self which is crying out for acknowledgement. And it turns out that by developing their nurturing and protective adult self, people can learn to self-soothe and limit the intensity, duration, and frequency of episodes of misery that afflict them, whether those are anxious or depressive or mixed. And the way you do that is by bringing to your mind and heart the moments in your own life in which you were kind and decent and gentle, nurturing, protective of someone else, particularly children. And if not children, there's not always a child in everybody's life, if not a son or a daughter or a niece or a nephew or a ward or anybody in the community who is relatively helpless and relatively dependent, then you can conjure these same emotions by relationship with a cat or a dog. Anybody who has less power than you, in whose presence are stirred up your feelings of protection and nurturance. Bring to mind that self state. Think of what happens when you're in the presence of your kitten or your child, and you feel rising up in you this nurturing and protective adult self. Well, by cultivating that adult self inside you and being aware that there are surviving, needy child parts of self also inside you sharing that psychic space, you can turn them to face one another and self-soothe. So you're freaking out with jealousy, with anxiety, worry, feelings of worthlessness, temptation to engage in an addictive behavior or use an addictive substance, resentment, whatever is coming at you in a kind of wave and threatening to take you over, you can alleviate by talking to that part of you, perhaps silently in your head or perhaps aloud, depending on the circumstances, and saying what you would say to your younger self or to a different child. And those words tend to have just the tone that you need. Okay, buddy, don't worry about that. Come with me. I have something for you. Come on, come with us. That kind of gentle encouragement that leads out beyond the difficult self-state with a kind of redirecting compassion And I learned how to do that by being in psychotherapy myself, which is part of the training, and by being in the training. Is that answer too long, or should I add something?
No, that's just fine, Jamie. Right. And, you know, I'm listening to you, I'm so aware that many of our listeners want to hear more about your approach to working with people who are aware of collapse and catastrophic climate change. And I'm constantly seeing posts on Facebook from folks who want to speak with a therapist who gets it, who really gets it about both. You know, and they say, I can't find a therapist who does get it, and they're afraid that they'll be pathologized or prescribed medication for simply feeling their natural human emotions about these issues. So I'm wondering, have you experienced working with people who are waking up to collapse and catastrophic climate change or other aspects of living in a time of demise?
I have, not as much as I had expected when I entered the profession, but there is more and more of it. And often it's not the leading thing with which the client presents. The client will present with anxiety or sadness or depression, feeling stuck. And as the conversations start happening and the rapport is established and the client comes to feel that this is a safe, confidential environment in which to be oneself and feel one's feelings, out come observations about the dire state of the world and what James Howard Kunstler in The Long Emergency calls the converging catastrophes of the 21st century. I never pathologize people's collapse anxiety or apocalyptic anxiety because I have that same anxiety myself. I have a handful of things that I find are useful to people for me to do and say. But ultimately, they are of little importance compared to the central thing, which is a relationship of trust and respect in which one can be oneself. That's the thing that heals. Some of the maneuvers that I referred to are in an essay that I understand you wanted to get to a little later, so I'll just mention the title, and that's Collapse Awareness and the Tragic Consciousness. They include some things that are not my favorite gestures toward well-being, but there aren't all that many different gestures toward well-being that can be made from within collapse awareness, so they're important. And the one I have in mind right now is simply remembering that our friends, the elephants, who are obviously non-human persons, I mean, anybody who's ever met an elephant knows that he or she is a person, but simply not human. Our brothers and sisters elsewhere in the ecosystem are being murdered and decimated. The African lion population is down by as much as 90% since 1980. Facts like this really sting, and they stir up feelings of helplessness, and it can help not only to have some personal agency by contributing $3 if that's all you've got, it's the symbolism that counts, to a wildlife organization. It can also help to remember, wait a minute, human beings have only been ravaging the earth for a few thousand years and only really rapidly and deeply destroying our only home for the 200 years of exploiting cheap and abundant fossil fuel energy in commercial quantities. So that means that there were several million years in which elephants and rhinoceros and all sorts of megafauna and small animals and plants and so on were unimpinged upon by human beings and had the run of the world in which to compete for survival and collaborate for survival, engage in predation, attempt to evade predators, and live the lives that they would live if they were unmolested by human beings and our industry. That happened. Yes, those millions of years are over with in time, but that doesn't mean that they never occurred. Only in a totalitarian society is the past a big nothing because it gets erased. airbrushed, photoshopped out, and put down the memory hole. But in the history of the ecosystem, there was a golden age that lasted almost an eternity. It's still heartbreaking that it is now coming to an end, but it can be helpful, as in one's own old age, to remember that one's youth and middle age really were vital and important and complex, and you got to live it. Now you're located on the far end of the continuum, but what is behind you is still real. It happens to be located in the past, but it occurred. I've got 5 or 10 of those up my sleeve, but that's what one of them sounds like.
Well, I want to get to that essay that you just mentioned a moment ago, but first, what's the best way to get in touch with you if people would like to find out more about your work?
Well, you can email me at jamiehecht@gmail.com. It's a strange spelling because, as I like to say, if you're born in 1968, you get a weird name, and that's jamieyhecht. @gmail.com. And you can also contact the Relational Center at relationalcenter.org and fill out the click mental health and fill out the intake form there and employ the phrase Jamie Hecht staff counseling, and the intake will be directed to me. You can also look me up on the web in the Psychology Today database, and any of those methods will work just fine.
So, Jamie, you are a poet, and I'd really like to hear some of your poetry. You have a poetry blog, which is Poetry Politics Collapse, all one word, poetrypoliticscollapse.blogspot.com. Will you share at least one poem that speaks to this existential, emotional, spiritual pain that so many people feel about the state of the world?
I appreciate that opportunity very much. My book of poems, Limousine Midnight Blue, is a 50 14-line elegies for President Kennedy, and there's a certain amount of collapse anxiety in that tragic text. But today I brought two poems, and I'll give you one for the moment, that are a little bit more directly concerned with the subject. And the first one is called Noah. The God could not be bothered to exist, yet he saw fit in his goodness to hassle Noah with a crazy plan to build an ark against the coming flood. The messages came in droves at first, messages in junk, in ashes of the ashtray, napkins, oatmeal, shadows of the trees on a liquor store's brick whitewashed wall. It all said, build a giant boat. So he did. He built it out of styrofoam and tape, green plastic empties, newspaper and twine, packets of soy sauce, plastic knives. It filled the whole backyard. Ordinary eyes, the dead eyes of the damned, saw nothing but a 22-foot heap of trash. But the ark was all to Noah, deep and tall, broad, spacious, and serene, austere, seaworthy. Here a pair of apes would sleep, and here two cheetahs, lulled by one another's warmth and breath and rumbling purr, would wait the slow duration of the 40 days. Here the male iguana and the female could repose along the corrugated cardboard wedges. No breeding couple of rhinoceros around. He had to settle for a picture from a magazine he stapled to a pizza box. The flood would come. The flood would sweep it all away. Strip malls, billboards, cars, until the ark alone remain drifting someday on an almost windless sea.
Oh, thank you so much for that, Jamie. That is just awesome.
Oh, I'm glad you enjoyed it. Thanks.
Yeah. So this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm Carolyn Baker, and I'm speaking with Jamie Hecht, who is a former colleague from the wilderness and old friend of Mike Rupert and editor for Mike during the process of writing Crossing the Rubicon. Jamie is now in training as a marriage and family therapist. And Jamie, you wrote this beautiful essay last July for Nature Bats Last called Collapse Awareness and the Tragic Consciousness. I'd really like you to comment on the article and tell us why you wrote it.
I wrote it to express some of the difficult feelings I was experiencing and to sort of join in fellowship of the people who are coping with the effort to confront reality. It's an uphill climb doing that, as you and your listeners will well know, because the people to whom you're attached, your family, your loved ones outside your family, your colleagues at work, friends, all are trying to be as happy and high-functioning as they can be, and as a tactical matter, they tend to withdraw their attention from difficult truths which might disturb their equilibrium. And from a practical point of view, that makes a lot of sense. There's an ethical pitfall in it, which is that you can only limit the problems and contribute to their solutions if you're willing to be that protective adult self and turn and face the strange, as David Bowie says, and really look at what's going on in politics and the environment. So people need social support in order to do that. It's very hard to do alone, and it's very hard to do with people who are unwilling to join you. So I think we who look at these matters, whatever stage of adjustment we're at in those five stages of grief, whether we've achieved acceptance or are still in denial, anger, bargaining, or a kind of salad of all those stages, which I find to be the most realistic description of the experience, it helps us to reach out to other people who understand, even if that's only a reaching out online, in a Facebook forum, or CollapseNet, the online entity that Mike Rupert started. And I wanted to express the way that literature, far from being a decoration, a mere aesthetic thing, or a badge of social status, you know, I went to the ballet last night. Well, good for you. Literature has something to teach us, as Wittgenstein says. As Wallace Stevens said, poetry helps people live their lives. John Keats called poetry a friend to man. And when we read Greek tragedies, such as the great Sophoclean tragedies, three of which I was fortunate enough to translate in a book called Sophocles' Three Theban Plays from Wordsworth Editions, we experience a very strange mixture of suffering and relief. We identify with the tragic hero and are purged of our terror. We sympathize from a distance with the tragic hero and are purged of our pity, says Aristotle in his famous book, The Poetics, where he formulates the notion of catharsis, purging us of pity and terror. The tragic consciousness is a kind of wholeness of thought and feeling in which, even though the story has a dark outcome that includes pain and loss, looking at the story as a complete whole, including the conditions which produce the crisis and the actions leading up to it, affords a kind of long-term perspective that is very similar to relief. Oh, one says to oneself, this is how this occurred. And it tends to contain the pain. And the tragic story in the case of the collapse of the biosphere from pollution, depletion, and climate change has to do with our fate as living creatures, because it's pretty much universal in the animal kingdom that an animal will exhaust its resource base, go into overshoot, and then suffer a die-off. why should that be tragic for us when it's not tragic for yeast in a vat eating all the glucose in the grape juice until the whole thing turns into alcohol and the huge population of yeast then dies off? Because human beings, unlike yeast, had the cognitive capacity, the capacity for collaboration, the sociality, to have a different outcome, and we couldn't manage it. Just as Oedipus knew that he was going to get a tragic outcome if he fought with a man old enough to be his father and married a woman old enough to be his mother and did it anyway because of compelling contextual reasons, human beings knew that if we consumed too much cheap and abundant fossil energy, if we deforested the planet, if we dumped battery acid in the river, if we didn't take care of the place and respect our mother instead of treating her as a giant toilet in which to evacuate our waste and a giant breast from which to withdraw the resources we need and not replace them, we would have a tragic outcome. And that knowledge didn't work. And when the knowledge necessary to avoid suffering is present but unusable because of the limits of human nature, that's the tragic situation. And that was why I wrote the piece.
Thank you so much for that. It just makes me want to run out and read it again. So what are some of the most important ways, Jamie, that we can prepare ourselves emotionally for the future?
Well, if we're not careful, we tend to assume that the course of action that is legitimate and ideal and worth doing is stopping climate change, reforesting the world, cleaning up all the toxic chemicals from Dow Chemical and Monsanto and so on. None of us can do that by himself. None of us can do that by herself. It does give us a certain feeling of agency, of the ability to affect things, the opposite of hopelessness, if we pitch in even a little bit. It's important to do that in order to cope. I would urge everybody to engage in even a small bit of repair, whether it's by donating money or time or getting arrested in civil disobedience, whether it's a giant commitment where you risk going to jail for the rest of your life, or if it's a tiny commitment where you send $3 to the Citizens Climate Lobby, let's say. Any kind of action will help. Even if you think it is futile, do it anyway, because your brain benefits from having the meanings there, the symbolic action. So I would recommend that. And I would recommend changing the goal from stopping all these problems, which is beyond our reach, to living in such a way that one minimizes regret and keeps the pain within livable bounds. That's the point of things, the desired outcome, is to live in such a way that you can tolerate the truth and still enjoy the time that we have. If that's the goal, why, that's much more feasible than making the Holocene last forever and rolling back the Anthropocene. It's too late for that. But if the goal is to feel okay, then when you're overwhelmed, you turn around and do something else for a while. You live in the body by engaging in sport or sexuality. You live in the spirit by engaging in religion or, closer to home with me, the arts, the fine arts, the performing arts. I act in a Shakespeare troupe because it's good for the soul. It won't prevent climate change, but it'll make me a better resource for the people around me, and it'll make me a happier man if I'm connected to the past by performing Shakespeare. So find the things that nourish your spirit and bring them closer to you. Avail yourself of them. Reach out. Become less isolated. Do some kind of work to repair the crises of the world, even if those feel futile. Talk to like-minded people about what's going on. And strange as it seems, look toward the fears and not away from them, not 24/7 and not when it's overwhelming. But if you read about how the world got this way, you can achieve the tragic consciousness, which subsumes or folds in or blends together the agony, the helplessness, the bitterness, into a larger, more adult, more ordinary knowledge of the whole story. And then you can close your eyes and slowly shake your head yes, saying, ah, that's what happened. I happen to be born at the historical moment when I'm witnessing the collapse of the biosphere, the American empire, civil society, genuine democracy in the United States. Oh, this is where I'm located in the historical continuum, and that's why things look the way they do.
To that, I would also add the importance of service. In terms of doing and action, Edward Abbey said action is an antidote to despair. Some form of service where we are really giving to the community or to another person or to animals, taking that energy out of ourselves and giving it to the world. So, Jamie, I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to have you on the Lifeboat Hour today, and I'm just wondering if you would share in the last few minutes, our time is slipping away, if you would share one of your other poems to finish the show, which I've enjoyed doing with you so much.
I'd be honored, Carolyn. Thank you. And the poem that I have in mind is called As for Life. As for life, others lived it before I was born. Others will live it after I am gone. Like you, I am living it now. Until today, this was something I simply knew. But now, it has a body like a bird, and the blue fact of it is hovering in front of me. My grandfather died in a bed between two chairs. My dad sat at his left, and I sat at his right, only three places to be, only one at a time. As for life, others lived it before I was born. Others will live it after I am gone. I am living it now. Only the stories within life have meaning. Life as a whole has none. No spy of God defecting to the mortal cause has brought his documents to Burger King. The universe can't move. It is not somewhere. Only the parts of the universe can have a place. Before I'm gone, others will experience youth. House to house, the tracks of them unfurl the dawn's ephemeral ribbon. I miss my mother. She had a nightgown made of silk that hung deep in the walk-in closet. When nobody was home, I crept inside and rubbed the silky hem against my cheek. Others lived it before I was born. The meaning of life is the location of the universe, the weight of the earth, the value of every dollar ever printed, heaped up to the sky. The world is, but it is nowhere. As for life, I am living it now. A strange poem.
Oh, I love it. I love it so much.
I'm glad.
Folks, this has been a wonderful hour. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have with Jamie Hecht. You can find more of Jamie's work at jamiehecht.com. That's jamiehecht.com. Or his poetry blog, which is poetrypoliticscollapse.blogspot.com. Thank you so much, Jamie, for being with us today. And thank you, folks, for listening to the Lifeboat Hour once again. We'll be back again with you next week. Good night.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Are loaded, everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. the bridge, that's how it goes. Everybody knows.